Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience, and it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had. And the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day. And everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All The Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-Bone at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-Bone.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Basically, as a coach, my whole thing was trying to be a better coach every year, right up until 2011 when I was done, because basketball is a great game because it changes, but yet there's still core values that you have to establish with your team, no matter what offense or defense you play. And so you had that, but then you had the opportunity to be creative.
And our guest this week is Gary Williams, one of the greatest college basketball coaches of all time. He's a Naismith Hall of Famer, probably best known for his years at Maryland, and he is a South Jersey native. Gary, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Matt. Good to be on your show.
So you've been retired from coaching since 2011. We crossed paths at the Penn American game last month. What are you doing these days? What's your role? I know you're still working with the University of Maryland.
Yeah, I do some work at Maryland just in terms of meet and greet in a lot of ways. And then just kind of I'm around, you know, if they have a question about anything, especially with basketball, you know, they give me a call and we talk about things. So it's really a unique time in both football and basketball now at the college level. And, you know, I'm just like everybody else. So I'm learning, trying to figure out what's going on, what's going to be eventual look for both football and basketball as time goes by.
Do you miss the coaching?
Yeah, I miss the actual coaching. I miss being on the floor in practice. That is where I always felt that I owed the majority of my time to, because you recruit those guys. And the idea is you're going to try to make them better, obviously trying to win games, but you're trying to make them better. And, you know, some of the things you learn that I learned as a player And I try to take that over into coaching is, you know, things players learn they can take with them after they leave college and go, you know, when they have their families, they have their kids, whatever. You know, they have maybe a jump start on some people. And so I think that's where hopefully you still have that today. I think with the one and done in the transfer portal, it's very difficult to keep a player that's good for any length of time. And I think that part might be missed quite a bit in today's game.
Yeah, kind of to that point, with NIL, with the transfer portal, how do you think you would have fared as a big-time head college basketball coach in today's environment?
Well, you either adjust or, you know, you're gone, because you're not going to win without good players. Any coach that thinks, you know, he's got all the answers or he's the reason, the only reason they win, you know, that's not true. And so how do you get good players? Well, you have to have enough money to pay players before, because the first question asked, and I don't blame the players at all, is how much are you going to give me if I come to your school? And so you better have an answer that competes with the best programs in your conference.
So let's talk about growing up in South Jersey. What is your earliest basketball memory? You grew up in Collingswood.
I did. And about, I'd say, 2-3 miles away is a place called Oakland, New Jersey. Home of Don Casey, by the way, one of the great coaches in the Big Five and professional coach. And I moved when I was 5 years old, and I remember going back to see a friend of mine, and he had put a basket, like a coat hanger basket, up on a telephone pole, and he was shooting a basketball. And I was 6 years old, and that's the first time I ever shot a basketball when I was six. And, you know, from there, you know, back then you played all the sports. You played football, basketball, and baseball. That's what you did. And it was a great way to grow up. As things went along, I played in the league when I was 9 years old at Collingswood Middle School, and had a great coach. The guy played for LaSalle, in fact. His name was Al Ferner. And I really liked playing for him. And I think that's when I really started to like basketball.
When did you start to feel like you got pretty good at it?
You know, basketball is a great game from the standpoint that, like baseball, I was a better baseball player than a basketball player for a while. But try to get 18 guys together to play baseball. I mean, that's hard. Basketball, if you got a ball and a hoop, you can get better. You know, you can get better. And I always enjoyed that by myself on the court with a ball, you know, because you can imagine back then in Philly, it was, you know, you're trying to be Guy Rogers, a great guard for Temple, or with the Celtics, Bob Cousy was playing for the Celtics. And so you wanted to be those guys. So you could give a running account. Like Williams goes to his right, pulls up, hits the jump shot. You know, you give a play-by-play, and that was all kinds of fun. And then you started to get – I was fortunate in my town in Collingswood. You played in some pretty good leagues at an early age. They had good programs for the kids, and, you know, I got a chance to play. And, you know, and I was always the right size for a guard. I was never one of those guys that was the biggest class guy in my class in seventh grade. So I was an inside player. And back then, the inside guys would go down one end of the floor and the guards would go the other in practice. That's changed now. But, you know, so I got a chance to be a guard my whole growing up. And I think that was very important.
When along the line do you start to think that you can be a college basketball player? Like, was that something early on, or was that something that was presented to you and you were like, oh, okay, that's interesting. How'd that come together?
Well, it was probably 10th grade. I played with your fellow cohort, Stan Pavlak, at Collingswood High School. And Stan was a junior and I was a sophomore. And Stan was starting to be recruited, especially by the Big Five schools. And so, you know, we practiced together. We played a lot together in the summertime. We go into Camden and play against all the great players from Camden and, you know, some really good outdoor courts back then. And, you know, I held my own. And so I thought, man, maybe I had a chance. I didn't think anything was definite for sure, but I thought I had a chance. And, you know, the one thing Stan Pavlak gave me was a work ethic, because especially back then, if you looked at Stan, you didn't look at him and say, wow, that guy's going to be a great player by the way he looks. You know, Stan really grinded it, really worked hard to become a player. And so I was small for a basketball player. So that was kind of the path I took. I didn't think that, you know, I had the talent to be you know, better than everybody else. I knew that I was going to have to work hard, but because I love the game, I was willing to do that.
And Stan Pavlik, great player at Penn and my current broadcast partner doing University of Pennsylvania basketball games, just to give people some context. And this is a golden era these years for the Big Five, but it's also great basketball in South Jersey. Just talk about kind of the fabric of South Jersey basketball in the time that you grew up.
Well, outdoor courts were really big back then. Most gyms were locked up on the weekends. Once practice was over, you couldn't get in a gym. So you played outside. And in the summertime, there were some great leagues. Collingswood had its own great league until they built the new high school right on the basketball court. So that did away with the outdoor courts. But then things shifted to Audubon, where we had tremendous games. Billy Melchione played there. Gordon Malava, you know, great Big Five players. Joey Cromer, Cliff Anderson would come over from St. Joe's and play. And, you know, we had some, you know, great games. And if you were an established college basketball player, you were coming up the East Coast or whatever, a lot of those guys would stop and play at Audubon. They had that reputation. You could get great games. And the games were good because you called your own fouls, obviously, but at the same time, there was nobody there that was looking to fight or anything like that, which can happen sometimes. You were just there to play basketball, and it, you know, you had to play well, because if you lost, you might not get back on the court that particular day, because there's always a team ready to go to play the winners of a particular game.
Do you have any specific special memories of your time at Collingswood High School?
Yeah, I do. When Stan was a senior, Stan Pavlik was a senior, I was a junior, we were good. We had Ked Gardner, who went to Clemson on a basketball scholarship. We had a player by the name of Wright, who went to Princeton and played basketball at Princeton. So we were good, but we had to beat Camden in the state tournament. And we played a great game at Convention Hall, and we thought we got robbed at Camden Convention Hall. We thought we got robbed at the end of the game and didn't advance. But, you know, that was a great memory. And then the next year, Collingswood had become a smaller school with all the large regional high schools that came in to play around then in the early 60s. So we went to from group four to group three, which is the second biggest group. So in our conference, we joined the Colonial Conference. That was Audubon, Merchantville, Haddonfield, those teams. Woodbury, I think, was in there too. And so we won the regular season Colonial Conference, but they made us play in group four in the state tournament, and we lost the first game to Millville, but we just weren't big enough. We had, I think, our biggest guy was 6'2". So, you know, that was it for me in high school. But, you know, it was great. I had a great coach in John Smith. He's a legendary South Jersey coach. And, you know, he probably created the initial interest in becoming a basketball coach.
So you go to play in college at Maryland. What sold you on being a Terrapin? And were there other schools that you were looking at?
Well, I visited Providence, Pittsburgh, and Clemson, and visited Maryland. I would have gone to a Big Five school for sure, but they didn't recruit me. I'm still waiting for my first letter from a Big Five school. You know, Jack Ramsey was St. Joe's. And, you know, when I wasn't as old as they were, but Jimmy Lynham, Billy Oaks, great guards for St. Joe's. And I thought I could be that guy, you know, playing for Jack Ramsey. And if they recruited me, I would have gone there without a doubt. Because back then, I mean, it was amazing how there was no Big East, anything like that. Big Five was as big as anything in college basketball. And those games, if you could get a ticket to a city series game, they used to call them, like Villanova played St. Joe, it was incredible, the atmosphere. And I just, you know, fell in love with the palestra, and that's where I wanted to be.
Did it bug you that none of the Big Five schools, like at that age?
It still bugs me. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, I thought I was good enough to play, and other schools that recruited me, but they really hit the Catholic schools in Philadelphia. The public schools were starting to be recruited. And so I guess coming across the river, that toll was a little stiff coming across the Ben Franklin. So, you know, that was it. Either that or I couldn't shoot very well. I think that might have been it, too.
So what sold you on Maryland when you went there?
Well, Cole Fieldhouse. I walked in. They bring in, on the recruiting visit, they bring in the top level there. And Cole was host to, I think, two Final Fours, regionals all the time. Back then it was on campus, 14,500. It was spectacular. If you could imagine a Palestra only had like 5,000 more seats, that was Cole Fieldhouse. Every seat was a good seat. It was a natural bowl. And, you know, the ACC was a good conference. nothing was on TV back then, so I didn't know that at the time. But, you know, it was a very good basketball conference. And, you know, so, you know, I made this decision to go to Maryland. And back then, you listened to your high school coach quite a bit. And my high school coach thought it was the best situation for me. And that played a big part in it also.
How was the transition stepping up from high school to college?
Well, back then, you got a break because you played freshman. You weren't allowed, you had your eligibility for the varsity. So we had a freshman team. We had a good freshman team. And you got to play against the varsity every day in practice. So you kind of gradually got used to the pace, the athleticism, you know, that was there at the varsity level. And so when I was a sophomore, I thought I was ready to go and play and, you know, was fortunate to get a chance to play right away because back then there was no scholarship limits. You know, it was pretty much, you know, if you were good enough, fine. If you weren't good enough, you were probably asked to go play somewhere else very quickly. So, you know, it was a fight, but it was, you know, I really liked it because you were competing every day. And the games were great. We had a great place to play. And, you know, I was fortunate because I never had a serious injury all the way through. And that doesn't happen very often.
What are your favorite Maryland playing memories?
Playing memories, let's see. Oh, my junior year, we beat Elvin Hayes in Houston in the old Sugar Bowl tournament in New Orleans. And then the next day we played Dayton, who went to the Final Four the following year, I think. They had Donnie May and Henry Finkel. Finkel was like a 7-1 player back then. So that was probably the two best wins. We beat Duke in overtime at our place. We beat Carolina a couple times, things like that. But it was very competitive. We tied for second my sophomore year, but we never did that well my junior and senior year.
So you mentioned, you know, kind of the coaching idea being planted in your head. When you graduate from Maryland, were you looking into that? Was it something that you were like, it would be nice if that's a part of my life, but I'm going to pursue something else? Like, take me back to college graduation. Where is your headspace on what the next step is in your life at that point?
Yeah, I was, I interviewed with IBM and Lincoln National Life Insurance Company. And I really didn't feel comfortable. I mean, I would have done, you know, you have to have a job. And so I would have taken them, but I had to come back and get my degree. It took me 4.5 years to graduate because I was in engineering. Now, that's not true. It just took me 4.5 to graduate. And I got to be a graduate assistant with Tom Young and Tom Davis. They were the assistant coaches then. Tom Young was a great coach at Rutgers, took him to the Final Four. Tom Davis coached Lafayette, Boston College, Stanford, Iowa. And so I got to be with those two guys. They were the assistants to a fellow named Frank Fellows. And they really were the reason I tried to pursue coaching. But the Vietnam War was going on right then. And as soon as I was done getting my degree, it looked like I was going to Vietnam. They had given me my physical and everything. And then I got a call from Woodrow Wilson High School in Camden, New Jersey. I think they changed the name to Eastside now. And they said they had a great coach there named Art DePatry. Stan Pavlak's father was a teacher there, which certainly didn't hurt me any in that situation. And he offered me the assistant, the JV coaching job. And I was all for that and not knowing anything how that would affect the draft or anything. But because of Camden was considered, and they called it an impoverished area back then. And if you had a job there, they struggled to get teachers sometimes to go in there. And so I was glad to do it. I was 23 years old and, you know, really happy to have a job. And you know, teaching was tough, but the coaching part was great. I really enjoyed being the JV basketball coach that year.
When you start coaching, did you know what you didn't know?
I just tried to teach what I knew. I had a very sound fundamental coach in college named Bud Milliken. He had played for Hank Iba way back in the day, and Iba was credited with helping man-to-man defense. And so I knew how to play man-to-man pretty well. And then I had a couple things that I learned from Tom Davis and Tom Young that I used as an offense. And, you know, that was it. And, you know, I didn't go out of my lane. I didn't try to do anything. And, you know, gradually, you know, we had a pretty good year as a JV coach. And then Art DePatry left. I think he went to Gloucester Catholic High School and they needed the varsity coach. And I got the job at age 24. So I was very fortunate to become a head coach and had an assistant there by the name of Stan Pavlak, who did a pretty good job as an assistant coach.
As an aside, you know, because I don't think a lot of people understand when you were growing up how the Vietnam War was kind of the backdrop and, you know, a concern for so many people that they were going to get drafted. Do you ever think about the possibility of, you know, if you don't get this job, if this doesn't come through, how your life could be completely different?
Sure. I look back and, you know, you just shake your head, you know, something like that. Our high school college, we had about 150 seniors, and I think five of the guys I graduated with in 63, they went to Vietnam. Two didn't come back out of the five. And I think about that quite a bit. And anytime I still talk to a couple of those guys, and, you know, you just appreciate what they did because nobody appreciated what they did. I mean, they were put into a situation. They didn't want to be there, but they sucked it up and did the best they could in that situation. And, you know, that was a time in our country that everything was changing. That was the first time people really criticized the government, said we didn't belong there. And, you know, whatever your political views were, well, you know, along with the Woodstock, along with, you know, everything that was going on back then, the Beatles, everything was changing. And it was, you know, I think the thing I like most about coaching back then during that period was coaching stayed the same. You know, in other words, players got a little different, but you still approach the coaching thing the same way. So that was the one stability that I had going forward, was that I had that where everybody else was kind of involved in all the social things that were going on.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Gary Williams in just a moment. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to drive smarter with high-tech features and excellent reliability. It's time for intelligent design plus exciting performance. Get a new vehicle you'll love. Check out the Honda Civic, Accord, or HR-V. See dealer for financing details. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with former University of Maryland head men's basketball coach and South Jersey native Gary Williams. So you take over as the head coach at Woodrow Wilson High School. Does coaching, do you fall in love with it immediately or does it take some time?
No, by then, because of my experience as a JV coach, I really wanted to see what I could do, but only from the framework of being a high school coach. I didn't know anybody, you know, back then it was Garfinkel, five-star camps, all those guys that worked for Garfinkel seemed to get the big assistant coaching jobs in college. And, you know, back then staffs were, if you had two assistants full-time, you had a big staff. And so there weren't that many opportunities. So I felt really, I was back home coaching, really enjoyed it. I liked the guys I had playing for me, and so everything was good. And so I was just going to run it as a high school coach and be very happy with it.
Did success as a coach feel the same as success as a player?
I was very frustrated as a player. I don't know how many players felt. I always felt I should have been better, you know, and I look back on that and how come you didn't do this? How come you didn't do that? But as a coach, basically, as a coach, my whole thing was trying to be a better coach every year, right up until 2011 when I was done, because basketball is a great game because it changes, but yet there's still core values that you have to establish with your team, no matter what offense or defense you play. And so you had that, but then you had the opportunity to be creative. You could make a tweak here and there, depending on the talent that you had, and go from there. And so I always liked that part of it. And that was something that it never got dull. I never was bored as a coach.
Now, you had success as a high school head coach. You won a state title one year. What was that experience like?
Yeah, that was my first year. I was 24. I think Stan was 25. And, you know, we had a really good team. We had five seniors who could really play. Ricky Brown, a great point guard. Tyrone Medley, who went to Utah, played for Bill Foster out there. Barry Smith, who went to Houston. Mike Roccobaldo, who went to Houston, but also was a baseball pitcher. He was really good. And Harold Sollinger, a 6'8". He was voted the best player in the state. He moved. That was my first recruit. He moved in from Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, Camden's got a line right down the middle. Half the kids go to Camden High, half the kids go to Woodrow Wilson. So we made sure he moved into our area so that he came to Woodrow Wilson. So we went 27-0. We beat East Orange in the state championship in Atlantic City Convention Hall. I think it was about 8,000 people there. And this is before the three-point line in 8-minute quarters. The game was 86-78. it was like one of the great high school games just to be a part of. And, you know, right then I figured, man, this coaching thing is pretty good. It's not that hard. So all those guys graduate, and the next year we were 12 and 13. So, you know, you get a reality check really quick in coaching, and that was my reality check. But I was very fortunate to coach those guys, and, you know, they were a great unit. A couple of them had grown up together, had played little league basketball all the way up, and that was a great year for me.
When it comes to setting, like, your coaching foundation, how important do you think was it to have those types of seasons back-to-back to kind of keep you striving, keep you humbled, and understand, like, how fragile it all is? I would think that you're not thinking this way in the time, but as maybe you think about your career, having those two experiences back-to-back would really kind of help kind of set in your mind what's possible in both directions.
Yeah, I think that was important because, you know, you win the state championship, you're 24 years old, you're feeling pretty good. You know, you're a little cocky probably. And then all of a sudden the next year, you're doing the same things. You're teaching the same thing. You're trying to, you know, put the team together. And, you know, we played in a good league. It was the big schools, Trenton, Atlantic City, Camden High, you know, all those schools. But we weren't good enough, you know, to be a dominant team. And I knew then that two things. Number one, you better get good players coaching. And number two, don't ever take it for granted, you know, that it's not always going to be there. You know, you're going to have to work really hard to make a living just like any other job. You know, coaching is not, you know, it's not an easy job because you're public with what you do. And people are quick to criticize, especially nowadays with the internet and everything. Everybody's got a lot of courage. And so, you know, you have to be tough enough to be able to handle that because, and if I could say anything to young coaches, that's what I tell them. I said, look, you got where you are because you're a good coach. Don't, you know, pay attention to all the criticism. Nobody likes it, but it's going to be there. You know, it's going to be there. Hey, they criticized Mike Krzyzewski when he was at Duke. You know, I mean, come on. So let's, you know, understand that's part of the deal. And coaches make a lot of money nowadays. You know, it's gone up so much in the last 10 years. I almost want to make a comeback. You know, it's like.
So you have this run at Woodrow Wilson. And I think you mentioned earlier that, like, you weren't looking for college basketball, looking to be a college coach. But you do start your college journey at Lafayette in 1971. What's the series of events that has you taking that step?
Well, that next year, 71, you know, I coached and, you know, we didn't have a great year, but I enjoyed that. And that was, you know, what you were referring to earlier. That was good for me because I could still enjoy. I didn't like to lose. You hate to lose, but at the same time, I could handle that. You know what I mean? It didn't drive me nuts that we lost. And so I was, okay, let's go. You know, we'll build another good team and see what we can do. But Tom Davis, who had been with me at Maryland, he was assistant coach there, got the American U assistant job. Tom Young became the head job. They had Kermit Washington. They went to the NIT. They had a great year. So Tom Davis got the Lafayette job. And he had told me that if he ever got a head coaching job, he'd give me a call and see if I wanted to be his assistant. And, you know, people are nice and they say that sometimes. So Tom really meant it. You know, he said when he got the job, he called me up. He said, I want you to be my assistant coach. One assistant coach, that's all they can afford. But I really want you to coach. And I said, great. You know, now that you mention it, yeah, I'd like to try the college coaching thing. And he goes, well, one thing. He said, they never had a full-time assistant basketball coach. This is 1971. The soccer coach left, and that's the money in the budget for the assistant basketball coach. So you have to be the head men's soccer coach also. And I said, nope, can't do it. My expertise in soccer was walking into class at Maryland, going by the soccer field when they were practicing, and you glance over. And I knew there was 11 guys on the team. I knew they had a goalie and you had to use your feet. But that was about, you know, back then, that's all anybody really in the country knew about soccer. So I turned it down twice. And finally, Tom drove down to my house and he said, what are you, nuts? He said, who do you know? Who do you know in coaching that's going to get you into college? And he was right. I didn't know anybody. So I became the, you know, the head soccer coach, the hardest thing I've ever done in coaching. I was 25 years old. I had seniors that were 22, 23 years old at Lafayette. I walk out in the field first day of practice knowing that they knew more about soccer than I did. And like, I just leveled with him. I said, fellas, you got to help me. You know, we got to do this. And, you know, it's got to, you know, we got to all work together. And it worked out because you could do a lot of the same drills. And you know, you just do them with your feet. So, you know, that was important that I took that job because I would have never been a college coach if I had not taken that job.
You had success with the soccer too, right?
Yeah, we were okay. I think I had the record there for a while, most wins in a season, but also had the record for most losses in a season. So it kind of balanced itself out. But we got pretty good. We beat Columbia, we beat Princeton. We beat some pretty good teams. And it really upset those guys that were coaching those teams because they were soccer purists. You know, they thought that they knew more about the game than anybody. So you kind of walked up and shake their hands after the game. And, you know, you knew how much that hurt them, that a basketball guy beat them. So I like that part of it.
How much did that experience, do you think, help make you a better coach? Just because maybe you start to get an understanding of what that's at the core of coaching. And in some ways, maybe the sport, I don't want to say is irrelevant, but a good coach can coach and will find a way regardless of the sport. Do you think that really had an impact on you, maybe as a basketball coach or in the big picture of your career?
I do, because I think from that experience as a soccer coach, there's always, you know, I always went into a season, no matter whether we picked high in a league or low in a league, as a basketball coach, thinking there's got to be a way we can be good. And that's how I approach that soccer thing. Look, I don't know much, but there's got to be a way we can make this happen and be good. And, you know, when we did have some success, that gave me the confidence that you could do that. You know, there was a way to find it. It might be, finding something out about a player that you could run a play for him that especially suited for him that makes our team that much better, you know, things like that. And so I was never narrow in my way of approaching a season. I was always open to somebody making a suggestion. I wouldn't always take it, but I was open. And, you know, and all the clinics you went to back then, you know, you were fortunate. You know, I went to clinics with John Wooden, Danny Crum, you know, all the great coaches from that era, and really learned a lot. And not trying to change completely what we did, but just to get a tweak, you know, get something from those guys that could really help us.
So you're at Lafayette for several years. You have a year as an assistant at Boston College. During this time, at what point do you start to think that I think I am ready for my own program?
Well, the thing I always liked was the scouting as a college assistant coach and the looking at tape film back then, getting ready for the next game, you know, trying to prepare, get ready for practice, whatever. And, you know, you see a lot of different styles of play that, you know, that's part of you don't realize it at the time, but you're really being educated by scouting, by preparing for a game, that type of thing. And so you start watching these guys that are very successful. And, you know, there's a couple common denominators that you get from them about how consistent they were with what they did and, you know, how much they believed in themselves, that they were doing the right things. And as you gradually watch, you start thinking, well, maybe I could do that. You know, maybe I can do that too. But you never, it was so hard back then because there just weren't that many jobs and, you know, you weren't making any money. Hey, John Wooden wasn't making money back then. So an assistant coach at Lafayette wasn't going to make money. And even a head coaching job, it wasn't going to change your life financially. And so, you know, you just stayed with it. And, you know, it came to a point I said, well, you know, you might as well be a head coach if you can get a job as being an assistant coach. What's the difference? You know, you're going to I always try to give it everything I had as an assistant coach, you know, for Tom Davis, because I was very loyal to him for what he did for me.
So your first head coaching job, American University in D.C. in 1978. What is it like when you take over, you know, your own college program?
It was amazing. I was at, as you said, I was at Boston College as an assistant. Tom Young left to go to Rutgers. And Jimmy Lynam had followed Tom Young. Jimmy Lynam left to go back to St. Joe's. And the job was open. And so Tom Young and Tom Davis recommended me for the head coaching position to the athletic director, Bob Fraley, who was really a good guy, because he took a chance to hire an assistant that had no head coaching background. So I go down there for my interview, meet the president, meet the players. That, you know, beautiful day in the spring. It was snowing in Boston. We when I left, and it was a beautiful day in D.C. at American U. So go back, everything, and I go back, and all of a sudden a friend said, hey, how'd it go? I said, tremendous. I said, the people were great. I really like the players, and I hope I get the job. And he said, well, what's the place like you play in? And I said, that's a good question, because they never showed me the place we played in. We played our home games at Fort Myer, a military base. And in D.C. at 5 o'clock and for a home game, we had to pack vans with towels and water coolers and all that, drive through the city of D.C. where the traffic was unbelievable to get to a home game. And so that was our home court. And I was grateful that we had a home court because, you know, we would have been a gypsy moving all over to different places to play. So that was the experience. And so I appreciated that, you know, and you look back at that and you go, wow, that had to be tough. But it wasn't tough because it was a head coaching. It was a Division I head coaching job. And I was so lucky to get that job and so appreciative that I knew I had to do a good job. And part of that was to show Tom Young and Tom Davis that they made a good decision by pushing me for the job.
What was the biggest lesson you had to learn as a Division I head coach?
Biggest lesson was to really understand that you need good players to win. That was... You know, you think you can coach, you think you can outcoach some people, but if you go head-to-head with a good coach and he has better players than you, you're probably going to lose. And so recruiting, you know, became a big part of things, but you had to recruit the right way at American U. You couldn't recruit, you weren't going after the best players. You were going to get some transfers. Guys who were really good high school players went somewhere, didn't work out, came back. Of course, back then you had to sit out a year. There was no transfer portal or anything like that. So we were able to put together a pretty much of a local team with good players. And it took me 2 years, but my third year, we were 24-6, I think, and went to the NIT, which is back then the NIT was more important. Plus it was a big deal for American University. And that was the year that I thought, okay, I can compete. I didn't think that I was the best coach, but I thought I could be competitive. Because we, in the old East Coast Conference, Temple, St. Joe, LaSalle were in there, and we had to beat them to win the conference.
From American, you go to Boston College, and I think the first year you're at BC, you guys have a great year, 25 wins, you go to the NCAA tournament. I mean, the Big East at this point is just a monster conference, dominant players, dominant teams. Like, what was that first year at BC and that success like?
It was incredible. Patrick Ewing was at Georgetown. Chris Mullen was at St. John's. We had a player named Michael Adams, a little guard. It was tremendous. And, you know, that was 83 was the year Valvano won it at NC State. We were the same region as they were. We didn't play them, but we beat Princeton. And then we played Ralph Sampson in Virginia, and we lost by 3. We were one down, drove the baseline, laid it in to go ahead with like 3 seconds left. Only problem was we stepped out of bounds, and it was a good call. You know, we stepped out of bounds, and we fouled. They made a foul shot. The game was over. But that was really a tough loss. But, you know, you learned then that, you know, the Big East was – it went from not a conference in 79 to 83 when it was probably the most watched conference in the country because ESPN had just come along. And they had established, you know, the worldwide network. And so you're on national television. We did Big Monday where we play. We were basically the only schools playing Monday. We had a great commissioner in Dave Gavitt. He'd call you and he'd say, hey, I know you're not going to like this. You got to play Thursday at 9 o'clock on a TV game. Then you got to come back and play Saturday at noon. But I don't want to hear it. He'd go, I don't want to hear it. It's for the league. It'll only help us. And he was right, you know, but it was, I mean, in that league, you went in there. I went in there. You had Jim Calhoun came in 86. He wasn't there yet. But Boeheim was at Syracuse, Massimino at Villanova, Luke Hornacekka at St. John's, John Thompson at Georgetown. You had Joe Mullaney, then Rick Pitino came in there. And so P.J. Carlosimo, Billy Raftery, then P.J. Carlosimo at Seton Hall. So you're going against a great coach every night, and you were going against teams that could play at a national level. There was no easy game in the Big East. Every game was there, and there were some physical situations in the Big East. You had to be ready. You know, you had to be ready. It's almost like a hockey game, you know, the same thing. You just had to be ready, you know, just in case anything happened. But it was great. I was young. I was, 36 when I got the job, and you know, those 4 years at BC were probably as much fun as I had as a coach.
From BC to Ohio State, what are your memories of your time at Columbus, and how big were those 3 years with the Buckeyes to kind of shaping you as a coach?
Well, it was great. When I was in the Big East, right before that, Georgetown and Villanova both won national championships. So my 3 years at Ohio State, Michigan and Indiana both won national championships. So we played in, against the best teams and coaches in the country, which, you know, as part of being a young coach, you know, you don't know it at the time, but you're learning a lot from those programs, and not just in terms of the coaching, but how they ran their program and things like that. So I was very fortunate to inherit a good team at Ohio State, and Ohio State's an amazing place. I would have never left Ohio State except Maryland was my school when the job opened up, and they were going through some things, and I thought, you know, I could get back a little bit by going there. I was no hero. I'm not sure I would have gone back if I knew, you know, how serious the things were there. But at Ohio State, you saw what big-time football was, obviously. 100,000 people at a football game, the Michigan game. There was one thing I'll never forget. My first year there, I always played the Saturday after Thanksgiving was the Ohio State-Michigan football game. It was at Ohio State this year, my first year. So Thursday practice, started 4. Time you look at tape after practice, you're probably getting out of there at 8, go out to the parking lot, and St. John Arena, where you played back then, was right across from the football stadium, and there was like 1,000 Winnebagos and, you know, trucks and all that stuff in the parking lot. So I asked the attendant there, I said, what do you, you know, being a wise guy from the East, I said, what do you got, some farm show going on here? The guy says, oh, no, the people are here Thursday for the, they're tailgating for the Saturday football game, and that's how serious that stuff is out there in the Midwest, you know, with the football. And so, you know, it was a great experience. And like I said, I learned a lot. And I probably would have stayed there as long as they would have had me, except that the Maryland job did open.
And that was kind of my next question. Like, as you're having this success, American, BC, Ohio State, like, is a goal, boy, it would be great to get back to Maryland and take over at my alma mater. Like, was that something that had been planted in the back of your mind?
No, not at all. I went to Ohio State thinking that could be a final stop in my career. What happened, Len Bias died in 87, I guess it was. Lefty Gisell was let go because of that, which probably wasn't very fair, you know, looking back. And Bob Wade was hired. He was there 3 years. They had some problems with the NCAA. And so he was let go after 3 years, and they needed a coach. And so they came after me. And I decided to go back. And I look back at that as probably as critical a decision I ever made in my coaching career, because that could have been a career ender. You know, it's the old, you know, they told me there was going to be a slap on the wrist from the NCAA. The slap on the wrist was 2 years no television, 2 years no NCAA tournament, reduction of 3 scholarships, and a big fine. And then I get there in 90. 91, Duke won the national championship both those years. Then Carolina won it in 92. And I'm trying to play those guys without, you know, the same tools that they had. So, you know, and people have short memories. You know, if we didn't eventually win, you know, it probably would have been somebody else coaching there.
It's your alma mater, but given all that you kind of inherited and had to deal with, was it as enjoyable those early years as in your other stops, or did everything you had to navigate just make it a much harder deal than maybe you were anticipating?
Well, that was the hardest thing I've ever done in coaching, without a doubt. Because on campus, there were some, you know, groups of people that weren't happy that Bob Wade was let go, that Lefty Gisell was let go. Maryland was looked at as the drug capital of the college world because Len Bias died from the cocaine thing. And so you had to fight all those things while you were trying to coach your team. And that became really tough. I remember going home a couple nights thinking, like, I'm not sure I want to do this. And then one day, and I can't tell you what day it was, I just said, hey, quit feeling sorry for yourself. Nobody made you take the job. You know, you were a grown man. You took the job, and you got to make it happen. So we kind of dug in at that time. I had great assistant coaches. Billy Hahn was one of them, who became the head coach of LaSalle after 2000. I guess he went there in 2001. And you know, we found a way to do it. We were able to get some good local kids. We got Joe Smith, who was the number one player picked in the NBA draft. Keith Booth was a McDonald's All-American out of Dunbar in Baltimore, played for the great Dunbar teams. So once we got going where we could get the local kids, we got good. We could compete in the ACC.
Time for another break. We will have more with Gary Williams in just a few moments. But right now, I want to remind you once again that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to drive smarter with high-tech features and excellent reliability. It's time for intelligent design plus exciting performance. Get a new vehicle you'll love. Check out the Honda Civic, Accord, or HRV. See dealer for financing details. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with Gary Williams, the former University of Maryland head men's basketball coach, Naismith Basketball Hall of Famer, and South Jersey native.
Did you enjoy the fishbowl of being a high-level basketball coach in a conference of the ACC and having everything scrutinized? And well, I shouldn't say, I don't know that anybody really enjoys it, but how long did it take for you to get used to having every decision, every mannerism, whatever it is, talked about, written about, stuff like that? Because I think you can expect it, but it's one thing to expect it. It's another thing to actually deal with it.
Yeah. You know, there were days where you just wanted to go home and lock the door behind you, you know, so nobody could get after you. But, you know, that became part of the deal. You started to make good money in coaching. We were in probably the most visible league in the country in the ACC. You know, with Duke and Carolina. But, you know, Wake Forest had Tim Duncan. Clemson had Campbell, who just unfortunately passed away. You know, there were great players throughout the Chris Paul. You know, all those guys came through the ACC. And so you were going to get the attention. And if you didn't like it, then you probably should have been doing something else because it was going to be there. And you just had to make up your mind that that was part of the deal. And you try to handle it as best as possible. And you don't always do a good job. You get upset at people. You get upset that somebody said something that was completely untrue. But you have to deal with it. And the one thing I found out, like I could get upset and not like what was said about me or about the team, but you had to be true to your team. In other words, you had to walk into practice and you couldn't BS the players. You know, the players had to know the truth about what was going on, about an article that was in the Washington Post. You know, that was your beat paper, you know, one of the top three papers in the country. That was, they had Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon covering our games. You know, it was like incredible. And both those guys were really good, by the way, because you didn't have to worry about them writing something that wasn't true. You know, they were very to the point. And obviously the success that they've had since then has been incredible. But, you know, there were some things written sometimes that were completely untrue. But what do? You don't want to turn it into a he said, you know, they said. And so you want it to be a one day story. So you just ignore it and you move on to practice the next day and somebody else plays and takes the attention away from you. And you had to deal with it that way. And it wasn't easy. But, you know, I think my experience in the Big Ten and the Big East helped with that.
You talked about like that you don't remember the day, but a time where you're like, hey, I got to stop worrying about this. And we got to get going. Is there a game, because I guess 94 is the first year you go to the NCAA tournament with Maryland. Do you remember a game where you felt like you had pivoted the program and that you guys had kind of put all the things you had to deal with in the past and now we're going to really start building this and it's going to start to move in the right direction?
Well, that year you mentioned 94, we started two freshmen and three sophomores and we were talented, but we were a little small, a little skinny. We weren't very big physically. But the year before, the last year of the sanctions, we had won three ACC regular season games. And so we went from that. We beat Georgetown in our first game. Back then, your first game was the day after Thanksgiving. And we played on a Friday afternoon, and it was on ESPN. So we got national exposure. There weren't a lot of games on at that time. And we beat Georgetown in their place in the old Capitol Center. They had Othell Harrington, who was a great player. But we had Joe Smith, Keith Booth, some other really good players, and we won in overtime. And that game gave all the Maryland fans, in addition to our players, myself, a sense that we could compete on a national level again. And so we did that, and then we were fortunate to make the NCAA tournament. and we got to the Sweet 16. We beat Marcus Camby, Calipari at Massachusetts to get to the Sweet 16. And then we lost to Michigan, who were the Fab Four by then because Chris Webber had gone to the NBA the year before. We lost to them in Dallas. And that year just solidified things where people felt that, yeah, Maryland can play at the ACC level and we can be a force nationally. And so 94 was the big year for me at Maryland.
And then you guys become an NCAA tournament regular. You go to the Final Four for the first time in 01. You win it all in 02. That first trip to the Final Four, do you feel like the program goes to another level when you make that type of appearance?
Sure. That is so different than anything else you do as a college coach. The media attention is just, it's something that you prepare for because you talk to other coaches that have been there and they say, get ready because, you know, you got to stay with your team. Don't let the demands from the media take away what you do with your team. But that's really difficult to do. And it's difficult on the players because, let's face it, we all like attention. And the players, they're just so excited about being there. And so was I. And everybody connected with the program because that was kind of like a glass ceiling in Maryland. You know, all the great McMillan, Elmore, all those guys never were fortunate enough to make it to the Final Four. And this was the first team. So we had to deal with that also. And we played great for about 25 minutes against Duke, who won the national championship that year. But they came and got us in the second half. But it was a good learning experience, and we had a lot of those guys back going into 2002.
Yeah, and to that point, if I talk to you like Halloween and I say, given everybody's back, given the success and the experience of last year, is it crazy that you guys could win this whole thing? Like, is that the mindset that is one of the goals here, a legitimate goal that we could be an NCAA champion?
That's a good question because I'll never forget this. I really believe with the guys we had coming back and our experience the year before that, yes, we could win the NCAA championship. But, you know, there's probably 30 schools saying the same thing. So back then, Midnight Madness was a big deal. And you couldn't start practice till October 15th. So midnight, October 14th. We had Midnight Madness in Coalfield House. They had to shut the doors. The fire marshals got involved, and you know we had to take care of them before we could do this. But we did all that, and then I got on a microphone, and he just had like a 8-minute scrimmage or something, and everybody goes home or wherever. And I told the crowd that we were going to win the national championship. And I never did that. You know, that's stupid. You know, to do something like that. But I wanted the players and the fans to understand that that was my goal for the year. And that was our expectations as a team. And our players loved that because they thought, you know, every once in a while, they think their coach is crazy. Well, that kind of confirmed it in their minds, you know, that I was crazy to say that. But to a man, they all believed that. And I knew they believed it. And so that's one of the reasons I said it. But I just wanted to make sure that everybody there, including the administration at Maryland, understood what our goal was for this year.
How did that change how you approach games, specifically once you get to the NCAA tournament? I mean, you guys went 32-4.
Yeah.
But like
we lost our first game that year after saying all that. We played in Madison Square Garden. This is right after 9/11. We played in late November in Madison Square Garden against Arizona, who lost to Duke in a championship game the year before. And so they were good, but we didn't play well. And everybody said, oh, here we go. You know, like, what's wrong with Maryland? And, you know, our guys were tough enough, probably from the year's experience of the previous year, to, you know, to put that aside and let's go play, you know, that type of thing. So we knew we were good. We lost at Oklahoma. We lost the second round, I guess it was, of the ACC tournament, which didn't bother me at all because it gives you a little rest in there and more time to practice. And, you know, so we were pretty much and we lost to Duke in the regular. We were 15-1 in the ACC and lost that Duke, beat Duke at our place. And that was it, you know, in terms of losses. So I knew we were good enough. But then, you know, the luck of the draw is really important in the NCAA tournament. I mean, you can get in a situation where you can get to the Sweet 16 without really playing, if you're on a good level, a team at your level. You know, you got to be lucky, or you can play two really good teams. Because some teams play their basketball, the best basketball, the 3 weeks of the NCAA tournament. So we opened with Siena and we played okay. Second half, we played well. But then we went Wisconsin. We went Kentucky with Tubby Smith. We went Connecticut with Jim Calhoun and the great players on Connecticut's team. And then we had to beat Kansas with Roy Williams, who was number one most of the year. And then we had to beat Indiana, who had won four or five championships. And I'll never forget that, walking in there for the final game. Indiana fans just assumed they were going to win that game, you know, because they had been there and they win, you know. Bob Knight was coaching, they won. And we didn't play great, but we won by 11. And that was, you know, something you'll never forget.
When in that game against Indiana, do you allow yourself to believe that we are going to win the national championship?
With about a minute left, because we had gotten out to a lead, then we let him back, and Juan Dixon, our great player, he should have been player of the year in college basketball. He was ACC player of the year. Jason Williams, Jay Williams, was in the league at that, in the ACC for Duke. Juan got the ACC player of the year, but they gave it to Jay Williams for the national player of the year. And Juan hit a jump shot, and from that point on, we gradually took it back out. I think we had it out to 14, and they hit like a 35-foot three-pointer at the buzzer. You know, we let them shoot, and that was it. But with about a minute left, we're up 10, 11. I thought we had it, and tremendous feeling. Something that, you know, you always hope you're going to get there, but you never think that, well, this is a year we're going to get there. You know, even though I said all those things and believed it, you know, doing it and saying it are two different things. And we did what we backed up what we said.
And how much, not that a national championship never feels good, but you ran off the list of teams you played, you know, Wisconsin, then Kentucky, Connecticut, Kansas, Indiana, almost like the who's who of the history of college basketball. To have that be the gauntlet you run to win the first national championship at your alma mater, did that make it even more special?
It really did. You know, just the idea that we didn't back into anything, because we had earned the right, I felt, at Maryland. We had built the program and earned the right to get into the tournament, and you earn it every year. Just because you were good the year before doesn't mean you automatically get in. And so then we started to play. We had to play well every night. We couldn't have a bad game leading up to Indiana. Indiana, they had some injuries. It was probably not a really strong. They had upset Oklahoma to get there, I think. And we thought we were going to play Oklahoma, and we had lost to Oklahoma during the year. So, but leading up to that, Kansas was really good, obviously. Connecticut was unbelievable. Caron, Butler, Gordon, all the Okafor, you know, just tremendous guys that went on and had very successful NBA careers. And Jim Calhoun told his team, this was the Elite Eight game at Syracuse to go to the Final Four. Jim Calhoun told his team at halftime that whoever wins this game was going to win the national championship. And I felt the same way. I didn't say anything, but I felt the same way, because I knew how good Connecticut was. And if they beat us, I didn't think anybody could beat them.
So after you win the national championship, how does life change, if at all?
I guess some people finally figured out maybe I could coast a little bit, you know, but it didn't really change. When you're in a metropolitan area like the D.C. area, Philadelphia, you know, the D.C. area, you have so many things going on. You know, you have major sports teams in every sport. D.C., you have the Kennedy Center. You have all these things going on. So it's not like you're the total focus all the time. So, you know, it's kind of like a thing where it's nice for fans to have blind faith. Our fans, I'd say, have faith, but you have to prove it, I think, as you go along. You can't rest on your laurels. And I think that was what, you know, we found out after that, you know, you still had to work really hard. Nobody's going to give you anything. And, you know, that was fine. That's the way it's supposed to be. So we look forward to it. And we had some good teams after that, not as good as the championship team, but we had several teams I thought were really good.
And you continued to have success. You decided to retire after the 2010-2011 season. Was that something that had been building and it was the right time? Was it something, was there like a moment where you're like, I just don't know that the energy is there or that I can get the engine started? Like, what went into the thought process of deciding to call it a career?
Well, basketball, you know, gave me everything in my life. You know, I didn't come from a, you know, family with a lot of money or anything like that. So basketball allowed me to get an education, first of all, and then, you know, go from there as a coach and, you know, have a good life. And I never wanted to cheat the game. And I could have coached probably 2 to 3 more years, I think, and done a good job. That would have taken me to 70 if I did that. But you look around, you don't see many guys 70. You know, you look at Tom Izzo today. Tom's done a great thing. He stayed at the same place, and he's gradually built that thing into a powerhouse. And, you know, well-deserved credit for doing that. But that's one way to do it. I changed places, and I was at Maryland 22 years. But, you know, every time you start up a program, it takes a lot out of you. It really does, because you have to do everything. You speak whenever people want you to speak. You know, you're going every night, you know, things like that. And, you know, it came to a point where I thought it was time for maybe somebody younger that could come in and, you know, really do a good job with the program. And, you know, I was fortunate to do what I did. And, you know, and that's all you can ask for. You know, I got the opportunity. I took advantage of the opportunity. But at the same time, you know, the work you put into it gradually, it's like any other job. It gradually, you don't want to get into a situation where you're just phoning it in. You know, you want the passion. You want the excitement. That's coaching. And if I didn't have that, I'm not sure I'd be that good of a coach anyway. So I think it was a pretty good time to call it quits.
That first year or so that you're not coaching, were there any struggles not having that be a part of your life? A lot of times I'll talk to athletes who have careers, and when their playing days are done, a lot of times they kind of almost lose their identity for a bit until they kind of rediscover something, or they kind of find their footing. You know, once you weren't a coach anymore, did you struggle at all not being the head coach at Maryland or not being a head coach anymore?
Oh, yeah. I missed I can only talk for myself, but you just miss the everyday practice thing where, you know, you walk into practice, your whole goal is to be a little better at the end of practice. Then in the locker room, that's where the fun stuff. Players say stuff in the locker room that you couldn't believe, that you couldn't get away with saying, you know, outside the locker room. But it's so funny. And it's kind of like no holds barred. You know, it's their little kingdom. And, you know, you better, as a player, you better not have a flaw, because they're all over it right away. And so you miss that camaraderie. You know, it's hard to get that somewhere else, especially with the politically correctness that was coming in the whole society. And so I miss that. I took a job with the Big Ten Network, and the people were great. I got to work with Jimmy Jackson, who I had signed Jimmy Jackson in November and then left for Maryland in May. And you think Jimmy Jackson didn't remind me of that, that the whole time we were together. But I wasn't ready for that. When you do that, I was doing games and some studio work, and I wasn't comfortable ever being critical of a coach or a team or a player. And they want you to do that. You know, at that level, you know, the Big Ten Network was, they were so far ahead of their time, you know, they were the first conference network, and it was just incredible out there in Chicago. And you had to travel to Chicago, you know, the plane flights and the weather and all that stuff were there. And, you know, did some games, did a game in Minnesota. That was as cold as I've ever been in my life. But other than that, and so I didn't enjoy it. So I stopped doing it after a year. And I thought I could do it after 2 or 3 years. But by then, you know, you're kind of removed from the whole situation. So I'm happy with what I'm doing. I'm do some work with Maryland and fundraising, things like that, and do a little bit with my golf game. It's amazing now, the ball doesn't go as far as it used to, but they're probably not making the balls as well. You know, as a coach, you can't ever blame yourself. You have to blame something else. So I think it's the balls that don't go as far anymore.
My final question, in your career in basketball, in coaching, what are you most proud of?
Wow. Most proud of, I think, is I see guys now from the early teams. They're, you know, some are in their late 40s, some are in their 50s. And to a man, they've all done well. You know, they've been successful. You know, there's been no GoFundMe pages for any of my players. And I think that's what you're trying to get through to them, that when I was tough on them, and I could be tough on players, and when I was, you know, I made sure the next day in the office or whatever that they understood why I did what I did. And I said, this is going to be good for you. You might not like me now, but you'll like me 10 years from now. And I hope that was true, because those guys were big and they could hurt me, you know, if they didn't like what I said. But, you know, it's just great to see. You know, that's the part that you probably enjoy the most, because you know how hard they worked to get where they did. We had to go You know, I think at Maryland, the one thing I'll say, we had to go through things my first 3-4 years that nobody else at that time had to go through. And so to get through that and to become as good as anybody else, that's probably the thing I remember the most.
Gary Williams, this was an honor. Thanks so much for the time.
Matt, thank you. Say hello to Sam when you see him.
And that will do it for this edition of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Gary Williams, former University of Maryland head men's basketball coach, for being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience. And it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had. And the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day. And everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All The Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-BONE at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-BONE.
So you want to start a business. You might think you need a team of people and fancy tech skills, but you don't. You just need GoDaddy Aero. I'm Walton Goggins, and as an actor, I'm an expert in looking like I know what I'm doing, even when I don't. And I like the sound of starting my own business, Walton Goggins Goggle Glasses. But I'm an actor. I don't know what I'm doing. I needed help. GoDaddy Aero uses AI to create everything you need to grow a business. It'll make you a unique logo. It'll create a custom website. It'll write social posts for you and even set you up with a social media calendar. I didn't even realize I needed a social media calendar. GoDaddy Aero will take your idea that sounds good and make a business that looks like you know what you're doing. GoDaddy Aero can get your business up and running in minutes. You know what that sounds like? It sounds like a plan. Get started at GoDaddy.com/Aero. That's GoDaddy.com/AIRO.